In the mid-50s, two men knocked over a kerosene stove during a fight at a concert. After fleeing the blaze, the guitar player realized he left his beloved Gibson inside. B.B. King then ran in and saved it. He later learned that the fight was over a woman named Lucille, and ever since, his guitars have borne that name. You can find Lucille at the Hard Rock in Hollywood, Florida. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Little Stephen's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
This is the Mighty Manfred, and it's time for your coolest conversations presented by Hard Rock and Little Stephen's Underground Garage. Thanks for listening. Please remember to follow, subscribe, rate, and review. I'll be speaking shortly with New York City-based singer-songwriter Dan Maraldi. His latest single, Magic in the Air, is also his debut for Wicked Cool Records. The song features our very own Palmyra Doran on the backing vocals, and the tune is a recent coolest song in the world. We'll hear a tad of it now, followed by my chat with Dan for your coolest conversations presented by Hard Rock and Little Stephen's Underground Garage. Here in Little Stephen's Underground Garage, and for today's coolest conversations, I am speaking with Dan Maraldi, New York City-based singer-songwriter. His discography includes 8 full-length albums and 8 EPs. He's a 2-time John Lennon Songwriting Contest finalist. Got a new single, it's Magic in the Air. It's his debut for Wicked Cool Records, and it features our very own Palmyra Doran singing on it. And Magic in the Air is also this week's coolest song in the world. Dan, my man, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you, Manfred?
Excellent. I'm happy to be chatting with you. You know, you call New York City home, but now I was doing some digging. You're from Cleveland, right?
Yeah. I mean, I consider New York's where I'm living. I moved here about 2014. I'm from Cleveland. I always enjoy being back in Cleveland, but I also, you know, just feel energized being in New York. Like, if you look at my career, there's kind of like part one, which is the Cleveland era, and then the New York era. But, you know, Cleveland's certainly dear to my heart. But I live here in New York, and this is, you know, the place for me.
Yeah, well, you know, Cleveland rocks.
It does.
Well, let's talk about period one for a moment here. I want to find out, like, that's where you grew up, your family's.
Yep.
Do you still have family living in Cleveland?
Yes. My parents are still in the Cleveland area, and I frequently go back there, play the occasional show and, you know, visit them. And I have sisters in Cincinnati, so I'm frequently back there.
Well, do you ever play the Beachland, the tavern there?
Oh, I've played the Beachland many times. Yep, the tavern and the ballroom.
How about Pats in the Flats? Was that before your time? Or
so I've attended shows at Pats in the Flats, but it was winding down by the time that I was aware of it. But that was a kind of historic place. I know one of the early White Stripes concerts was famously at Pats in the Flats.
Well, I wasn't there for that, but I was there when she was turning some hamburgers on the grill.
Nice.
Yeah, it was nice, actually. Very cool. So your family living there, a rock and roll family? I mean, there's music going on all the time?
Yeah. So my dad was a piano player. He would, you know, frequently be, you know, he liked all sorts of, you know, popular music, but he also had a foundation in, like, he would be playing classical pieces. He'd be playing ragtime, and he sometimes would compose his own ragtime pieces as well. And then my mom was always a great appreciator of music, loved like you know, Motown and but all, you know, and also like she was a big Rod Stewart fan and supportive of, you know, my love of like Elvis Presley. And she actually gave me all her 45s when I was about 8 or 9 years old. And so that sort of was a great gift to go flipping through those and learn how to set up the turntable. So one 7-inch dropped on top of the next one and then the next one.
I know. Isn't that great?
Yeah.
So you mentioned having some sisters. How many sisters?
I have 2 older sisters.
I was wondering what the order. They're 2 older sisters. So did you get some hand-me-downs from them music wise as well?
I feel like I actually showed them more stuff. I know that, like my oldest sister, she was a big fan of, you know, musicals. So I, you know, definitely heard a lot of like the popular musicals of the '90s, just around the house. But, my sister Emily, I would let her borrow CDs and, you know, back and forth and things like that. But I was the one who was really into finding out more about rock and roll and its history and, you know, how one thing led to another and influenced this and that. So I've always been that guy.
Well, I know you play guitar. Is that your first instrument?
So I think of myself as a singer, but I've learned how to play guitar for the sake of being able to, you know, finish my own song. So I don't consider myself like a great guitar player, but I'm a competent rhythm guitarist, and then I can play other instruments well enough to like get me in trouble. So there are some recordings where you'll find me playing drums, but not on Magic in the Air, but drums and bass and keys and things like that. But I would say singing, but I probably, if I have to accompany myself, probably on the guitar.
Well, you mentioned singing. So when you were in, you're a kid, you're growing up, you're high school, so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Were you forming bands and singing, or when did you actually start picking up a guitar?
Yeah. So what happened was I had, I'd wanted to form a band, and I'd be asking people to join bands. And finally, towards the end of high school, I was able to get, 4 people together to be the band where I didn't know how to play guitar, but I knew how to sing, and people knew I knew how to sing. And I had been writing lyrics down in a notebook where I knew I hadn't been really advertising it too much, but I had this book of lyrics and melodies. So I could open up the book and sing you what the song was, but I wouldn't exactly know how to play the chords. And so in high school, my friend Mike and I, he was playing guitar. And so I'd sing him the songs. He'd figure out the chords underneath the songs. And then, end of high school, he's going off to school in a different state. And I wanted to keep writing songs. I wanted to keep playing music. Cause finally I had a band and, you know, once you've, you know, discovered electricity, you're like, I gotta keep doing this. So then I saved up my money and got a knockoff of a white Les Paul and started. And since I had spent $250, which was the most expensive thing I'd ever purchased at the time, I was like, okay, I need to now learn how to play this. So that opened up that door and I started playing guitar.
And how old were you now?
I was 18 at the time. So in terms of guitar players, I kind of started a little late.
So I was wondering, is that... Well, you mentioned getting the electricity. What was that the moment that you decided going forward, music is my life, or was this sort of something that was still?
I knew that it was something I needed to figure out how to continue to keep going forward. And then I went to a liberal arts school in Ohio called the College of Worcester. And while I was there, you know, it's kind of in the middle of Amish country, and so in that bit of not having much going on, I just wrote and wrote and got better at writing songs, and, you know, being influenced by classes and things like that. But I would also then keep going into Cleveland, play shows, then return to school, things like that, until it got to the point where, you know, I'm winding down, you know, college. And then it was like, I feel like I need to take some time and see what happens if I, you know, jump in and do music full time. And luckily, I've always had very supportive parents who, you know, believed in my music. And they were like, you know what, you should go ahead and see what happens. So
So the see what happens moment.
Is that the end of period one? Is that the end of Cleveland and on to
No. That's the kind of the beginning of then, like, I started recording my first solo album from like kind of like the best of the songs I wrote in college. And then I formed a touring band. And then we started doing regional tours over the next few years where, you know, we were always tethered back to Cleveland. But we'd play New York, we'd drive up to Boston. We'd go down to Florida, drive through Georgia, you know, Texas, St. Louis, things where we were mainly on like the middle of the country, and east was kind of the direction that where we would do all these regional tours in our van. And then, you know, we were doing that. We were putting out records, and, you know, responses were good from critics, but it was also just like, it wasn't becoming financially viable, but I knew that I needed to find a way to keep going forward. And I discovered that there were music business master's programs, and I could get to New York if I got into the NYU music business master's program. And then sort of try to figure out, let's learn some new skills and see how I can apply those to my music career. And that's when I moved to New York.
Okay. Before we get to moving to New York, when you were doing these regional tours, was this under your own name?
Yeah, it was under my name. I had a backing band called, booked as Dan Maraldi and the Albino Winos, which was a reference to the Albino was a reference to my love of the Beatles White Album. And then I also love the Stones, and Keith Richards has the expensive winos. And that's where, so that was the lineup that would tour.
Well, that's a great name. All right. So then phase two begins here, where you're thinking, I want to keep pursuing music.
Mm-hmm.
So try and figure out some new skills to be able to do that. And you got into, did you say it was the music business program at NYU?
Yeah, the Steinhardt NYU master's program, yeah, for music business.
And how long did you pursue that?
It was a two-year degree. So while I was here, I kept playing shows, frequently playing at like Bowery Electric, Arlene's Grocery, going to class, doing, you know, exploring different aspects of the industry. But always writing, always figuring out like how to make the next record and things like that.
And putting out the next record as well.
Yep. Yeah. So when I moved here, I had actually recorded my third studio album, but I waited a year to sort of see if I learned anything about how I should release it during that first year of grad school. But after about a year in the city, I had a creative burst and just wrote a whole bunch of songs that were about New York, and just about, like, you know, life over here. And that was just a really fun period.
And I guess since you had played in New York City, you already knew.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I've been there. And in the first couple of years I was here, my sister Emily, who now lives in Cincinnati, was doing a postdoctorate at NYU. So it was nice. I had family here, you know, while you're, you know, adjusting to being in the city. And then I was also able to make friends starting the program. So it was an exciting time.
So how does this this John Lennon songwriting contest thing fit in? And what is that? You were in New York City when you submitted songs to that?
So one was done when I was in Cleveland. I had a song called The Holy Roller Stone Revival that was on an EP of mine called Tease. And, you know, fresh out of college, I was applying to more, you know, songwriting contests, just trying to get noticed. And that one made it to being, I've referred to actually both of my John Lennon songwriting recognitions. I refer to as the songs that almost won me $20,000. Cause that's like, if you win the whole thing.
Yeah.
So that one was,
you didn't get like a. What do you say?
I got a magazine subscription. And then
calendar, maybe they didn't give you a calendar or something.
Not a calendar. I think one of them, I think I got a magazine subscription and then like a recording interface. And then the second one was actually for in the category. So first one was for in the category best rock song. And then the second one was a song that actually qualified and was awarded in the folk category. And that one, I actually got a really cool fuzzy guitar pedal that I use to this day. So that prize I actually used.
What can you? I think you mentioned the name of the first one, but can you mention again what the names of each of the songs?
Yeah. The first one was the Holy Roller Stone Revival, and that was on an EP called Tease. And then the second one was called Junkie Friend, and that was on a record called Chaos, Destruction, and Dancing.
So overall, your experience with that was pretty good then.
Yeah, no, it was nice. And they always arrived at like a point where, you know, being an independent artist, being out there, it can get really discouraging and also you can feel like a ship adrift, or releasing a record feels like throwing a message in a bottle into the ocean and you really hope that people hear it. And so to have that come back, because the Beatles are my all-time favorite band, so the songwriting contest that was in John's name, they were nice little beacons of hope when I needed them. So
you mentioned going back to high school days, maybe even before the preteen days, I'm not sure when, but you started writing song lyrics down, thinking of melodies.
Yeah, I was about 13 or 14. I started just like keeping a notebook of song ideas and knowing what like the melodies were and just, yeah. Songwriting, it, you know, in terms of having something that was presentable to people, was around when I was about 17, when I started working with my friend Mike, and he was helping figure out the chords underneath the melodies I was singing. And that's when like the magic of songwriting was like truly unlocked.
That's what I was wondering. Yeah. How did you learn how to write a song? And I guess, yeah, well, how did you learn to write songs?
Well, I would say that I listened to a lot of songs. So it was something that kind of felt pretty instinctive, where, you know, I knew what a verse was, a chorus was, but I remember being like, and then this is the different part. And then Mike would be like, that's called the bridge. And so once I kind of, you know, once you started writing the first or second song, you were kind of aware of like, okay, this is the structure of a lot of songs kind of have these pieces, and knowing what to name the different pieces and things like that. So
tell me a minute about Mike, because he was pretty important to you there. Then he went off and did his own things.
Yeah, he went to school in Colorado, and now he's a pilot in Alaska. So
wow. Now when you say he's a pilot in Alaska, you mean for Alaska Airlines, or is he like some kind of bush pilot flying into north of the Arctic Circle?
I feel I think it's kind of a more of a, yeah, I'm not sure the exact, it's not for Alaska Airlines, but I think it's like deliveries and things like that, where, you know, fly remotely to places up there in Alaska. But yeah, no. He was certainly important in helping me, you know, discover how to write a song in those early songs.
Now, does he appear on any of your recordings at any point?
Not anything that is in circulation still. I mean, because there were some budget records that were made under different band names. The band we had in high school was called Exit Suburbia. And so there were some self-released, self-pressed CDs that are not on streaming that he would have been on.
And is he the same age as you, or is he older?
Yeah, he was the same age. Yeah, yeah.
Well, let's talk some about this magic in the air.
Yeah.
Coolest song in the world, single on Wicked Cool Records. When did you write Magic in the Air?
I wrote it in actually June of 2023. I was writing a bunch of songs. Like, you know, there are times where you feel like you're heating up and songwriting, it's like a lot of songs are happening at once. And you know, sometimes you have to wrestle with the songs to bring them through. But this one happened to be in a period where music was coming, and I was just trying to record the ideas down, write the lyrics down as quickly as I could.
Well, I've read that it's inspired by life mm-hmm. in the Big Apple, New York City. What was so magical about New York City in 2023?
Well, I was getting ready to get married. So there was I was setting up, I now live in the neighborhood of Ridgewood, Queens. I think it was magic because, I was adjusting to a new neighborhood, but also, and, you know, big life events, but I also, you know, there's, I love making records. I love songwriting. And those then, and when you're able to, when songwriting's happening, you know, feeling kind of effortless, like that itself is just super energizing to me and like uplifting to my overall mental well-being. So I was feeling good.
In the song, there's a line, something about judgmental eyes. Well, they ain't going to bug me.
Yeah.
How old are you?
I am 39.
Or do you feel, I mean, there's always when somebody, or my experiences, you know, as we were pursuing, let's say, you know, the arts, song, mm-hmm. writing, performing, could be a lot of pressures to change a life, sort of the direction. And you mentioned your parents being very supportive. That's an important thing right there. Very much so. Do you feel more pressure now than before? Like those judgmental eyes, are they still bearing down on you? Or is that something that is a stress? Or is that something that you can still sort of, you know, I'm living my best life and, you know, there's this magic in there still for me?
I think it probably comes and goes where you, you know, feel the pressures of society, but then you also know when you're being your true self and living in the moment. You know, so it comes and goes. And in the context of the song, you're just leaning into that, the joy of life.
Our very own Palmyra Del Ram, big fan of yours. She sings on the song. How did you two meet?
So I had a song. I have a side project called the New Preservation Society. And I was able to convince her to spin one of our songs. And, you know, we began a correspondence, and then once the pandemic was winding down, shows started happening, and I would go out and see her band, and you know, just a natural friendship came about. And she's just always been somebody who, when it is encouraging, when I have new music, she's always excited to hear it, and you know, you really learn to treasure those people who champion your work and value you and see the value in what you're creating. So that means a lot. And she's so talented in her own right. And she's just cool. My wife and I love her. She's just the best.
And how did you go about saying, "Hey, Palmyra, I've got this song. Get on board."
So as I was putting the collection of songs together. And also as I was writing it, I was hearing the way, like the inflection of her voice on certain lines. And I was like, oh man, maybe she would, I don't know if she'd be into it or not. And so I threw it out to her and she liked the song. And then it was just a matter of like locking in a time when she was available to knock out that vocal, and we were able to get her to do it. And she did great. And so it was special getting that to sort of the idea and then it manifesting.
And when and where did you record the song?
So most of the recording was done in my apartment bedroom, where I work frequently in GarageBand, where I'll first start off by, you know, having a fake drum track. And I'll dub my rhythm guitar and my vocal ideas. And then there's a guy I know that I've actually never met in person, but he's played on a couple different records of mine remotely. The drums, his name's Pablo.
Well, tell me, let me hear about Pablo for a minute. So where does Pablo live?
Pablo lives in DC. His artist name is Pablo For Hire. And, and a friend of mine who actually, my friend Jay, who played bass on the track, because I can play drums okay within a certain context of drumming, but like I joke that drummers can kind of be broken down the way like packs of crayons are. I'm the 8 crayon pack, and then there's like the 24 and the 48 and the 64 and things like that. So I only have so many different shades I can color with as a drummer. And so my friend Jay had worked with him on a song and was like, he's set up to record remotely, see if he'll do it. And then it just became you know, a relationship throughout the pandemic that I was able to do my, like, the basic part of the song, send it to him, and then he would record real drums and send those back to me, and then I would swap those in and keep recording my pieces onto to finish, you know, the rest of a track. And then with Magic in the Air, that's how it worked. And then I had I worked with a lead guitarist who plays in a band. His name is Michael Gugino, and he plays in a Brooklyn psychedelic trio called Freaky Wilderness. And he was a friend of my wife's, and I was like, and I had never, you know, worked with him before, but I was just kind of curious to see what would happen. Had him come over, and he played on four songs, including this one, one evening. And then my friend Jay Niemeyer, who's from the DC area, he came up, visited for a weekend. I sang on a track for one of his he has a band called Color Palette. And I sang on that. And then while he was there, I just had, he's sort of a jack of all trades, where he played bass on some stuff, he played lead guitar on some stuff, and he played that that bass line that kind of pumps through Magic in the Air. So those were, and those parts were all just done in my bedroom on GarageBand. Then for Palmyra, we went over to Renegade, and then Jeff Sanoff engineered Palmyra's vocal track and bounced that to me. I assembled it back in GarageBand and then sent it off to my friend Kyle Downs, who actually has been mixing my stuff off and on since like 2010. And so he actually mixed that first John Lennon songwriting contest song. But he always finds a way to, because I, you know, certain songs I require, like, you know, an adult to mix, as opposed to, I feel comfortable mixing some acoustic things, but when it came to like the full drums rock thing, then I will send the files to Kyle, and Kyle will add that shine and polish that I need to finish the record.
This tune, you said, was written, you mentioned, like, back in 2023. Why record it now? Why is this the debut single?
Well, that's an interesting question. It's been, you know, I've just been, you know, sort of searching for a home for this collection of songs. And so this has been just kind of floating around. And I was delighted that, you know, it got Stephen's stamp of approval, and a lot of gratitude to Rob and Kurt, who I know were enthusiastic about the track. And so
you said Rob and Kurt, you're talking about the fellows at Wicked Cool Records.
That's correct. Yes. The legendary Kurt Baker and Robbo at the movies. And so they've been supporting this release for a while. And so it was good to just get that stamp of approval to be able to have it come out on Wicked Cool.
Is there a plan for a full length album?
There could be. But we'll just see how the world reacts to this first single.
All right. So today is the 22nd. You had a release show for the single last Saturday on the 16th.
Correct.
The place is called, what's it? It's
Bar Frida.
Bar Frida. All right.
Yeah.
You have any other shows upcoming?
There will be more down the road. I'm playing rhythm guitar for Kurt Baker at a show in June at the Bowery Palace, where I think the Dolly Rots are playing. Yes. And Bobby Mahoney.
Yeah.
But I will be there in a supporting role of rhythm guitar and backing vocals. But that's going to be a fun night. I'm really excited about that show.
Well, you know, I'm just planting the seed there, but you should play Magic in the Air. So Kurt could call you over to Mike. Hey, we got, you know, look, we got Damaroli up here on stage. Let's hear a tune from you.
You can run.
I'll ask Kurt about that. How about
that?
Yeah,
you can ask. Yeah, you can ask Kurt. When it's the Kurt Baker show, I let Kurt Baker call the shots on.
Yes, true. That's probably best.
He played rhythm guitar with me at the Bar Frida show, where my regular lead guitarist was unavailable, so Kurt took on half the set, and then our friend Fred is doing the other half of the set on lead guitar. So so it has a fun chaos to it.
Yes, very fun. Well, I want to talk, we're going to go out with a track off of your 2024 album, Ulysses. I want to talk about a couple of songs there. One I wanted to ask you about, well, both, I'll have to say, very topical in our current age. One is Unfollow Me.
Yes.
Yeah, pretty timely tune for a current social media driven world. Is this, I was wondering, is it, you get a great line in there about some dude creeping on photos of your lady and thinking, hey, is that based on any real world interaction?
Well, I can't be too specific, but, you know, I think that, you know, there was a time in the pre-social media era where, you know, time would go by and, you know, people would fall out of touch, but, you know, certain friends would stay in touch in their own way. Whereas you're kind of in this world where the algorithm is always just trying to get you to keep on, you know, social media by being like, do you know this person? It keeps like showing you, you might know this person then and so forth. And you'd be like, I haven't seen that person in 20 years. And then, you know, they send you a request and you're like, okay. And you'll see how they're doing and what conspiracy theories they're really into. And then the algorithm will see that you read the post and they'll be like, let me give you all the content about this person. Just when you're like, okay, I wasn't that curious to begin with. I wish them well. I really wish them well, but you know, so it's like a bit of a, it's, you know, tongue in cheek done with humor and love, but yeah.
I like that humor and love. And he made a video for that one. So I'm assuming people really connect with that song.
Yeah, that was filmed. My wife is a screenwriter and a director. And we were on our honeymoon in Barcelona. And so we just, we had access to a nice hotel room and terrace. And so we just had fun with that one. And
she served you breakfast in bed?
Yes.
The other tune I wanted to mention off of Ulysses and us to take a listen to, it's called Internet Women. And I really, what I love that the groove there, the poppy kind of sort of a 60s groove going on there. And I was wondering what came first with that one, the lyrics or the music?
So that's funny. That one had, like, the riff of that had been in my head for, I don't know, like maybe about 4 or 5 years, where I had the beginning of the song, I had that riff, and then I had the melody idea where it was like, I've been, like, the opening line is like, I've been sleeping in Bushwick, been making a habit of an internet girl, where at the time, you know, I was on dating apps, and then I was in a relationship, and then the relationship ended, and then I was back on the dating apps, and I was like, I really like this riff. Let's try to finish this song. And then I met my wife, and so she kind of gave me the lyrical inspiration of how the song progresses with that third verse about being in Ridgewood and farewell to Manhattan. I'm borough bound, and so I, you know, now live in one of the boroughs outside of Manhattan. But so the riff came first, and then I finally figured out the story. I just had to live some more life. And I did meet my wife on the internet. So that's where it all kind of ties together.
Oh, that's great. That is great. Dan, thank you so much for talking with me today on our Coolest Conversations.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
We're going to give a listen now to Internet Women. It's Dan Maraldi off Ulysses in Little Steven's Underground Garage. Singer-songwriter Dan Maraldi here in Little Steven's Underground Garage, sharing his experiences with internet women, a song from his album Ulysses. This is the Mighty Manfred, and thanks again to Dan for speaking with me today on our Coolest Conversations. Thanks also to Kurt Baker for producing our podcast. Evan Stanley and Nick Simmons have got a very unique relationship. Friends since childhood, their fathers are Paul Stanley and Gene Simmons. The two sons, though both musically active, have until now not worked together, but that has changed with the advent of their project, Stanley Simmons,
And Evan will join us next time around to tell us all about their singles and upcoming album. That's Evan Stanley of Stanley Simmons. Next time here for your coolest conversations in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
Buddy, you're a boy. Make a big noise playing in the street. I'm gonna be a big man someday. You got mud on your face, you big disgrace. Kicking your can all over the place.
Some things are better when they rock. The Seminole Hard Rock Hotels and Casinos rock around the clock with nonstop casino action, rooms fit for the king, pools, spas, restaurants, and clubs for every taste and temptation. Seminole Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Tampa or Hollywood, Florida. We will rock you.